Our scripture reading this evening will be from Matthew 22, verses 34 through 40. Matthew 22, 34 through 40. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets."
But good to be with you tonight, and I appreciate you have taken the fact that you have taken time out of your day to come back and to study and to worship. And I hope you have your Bible with you and follow along with some passages tonight as we look at this topic of making Jesus our everything. We mentioned in Bible class this morning how sometimes we say things, and I don't know really if they're true. We say them. They're right. They're the right answer, but I don't know that they're the true answer. We sing songs like, "All to Jesus I surrender." And, you know, we sing that song, "All to Jesus I surrender." We sing songs like, "He is my everything. He is my all. He is my everything, both great and small. He's everything to me." We sing songs, and maybe your song books have the song, you start out first verse, "All of self, none of thee." You know the song I'm talking about, and you make this progression till the last verse. Now you're none of self and all of thee. Aren't you glad that God doesn't strike us dead for lying like he did in the first century? Because I wonder how many of us would just drop like flies during singing those songs. "All to Jesus I surrender." Well, there goes one, because he wasn't telling the truth. I know that we know the right answer, but I don't know that that right answer is always the truthful answer. It reminds me of a story of a little boy who went to Bible class, and the teacher said, "Okay, children, what is it that has four legs and scurries around on the ground, collects nuts for the winter, has a long bushy tail and can climb trees? What is that?" And nobody would answer. She said, "Come on, tell me, what is that?" And nobody would answer. Finally, she said, "Johnny, tell me what that is." And he said, "Well, it sounds like a squirrel, but I'm going to go ahead and say Jesus." We've got to say, you know, we're in Bible class. We have to talk about Jesus. And that's the way sometimes we do. I would ask our youth group. I taught the youth group class for, 25, 26 years or so. And I would ask them, "Okay, you got to get ready for school and you only have time to do one of these two things. Which would you leave undone? You have time to either read your Bible or brush your hair." And you know what the kids would say? "I'd read my Bible before I went to school. I'd just leave my hair a mess." Liars, every one of them. They would not. That's the right thing to say, but it's not the truthful thing to say. And we're not far from that, I think. As adults, we've learned how to play the game, and we know we're supposed to say, "I want to go to heaven more than anything." But do we really? Is Jesus our everything? That's what I want us to talk about tonight. And I want us to, here's the fact. Yeah, he's supposed to be, and I think everybody here knows that he's supposed to be. But here's where the rub comes. How do we do that? How do we make him our everything? Knowing what to do and knowing what we should be is different than how do we do it. A few years before we moved down here, we had doubled the size of the building where I was preaching in Glasgow. And it was an open house. It was Saturday. The next morning would be worship, and then we were going to have an open house and show everybody the new section of the building. The women had worked up in the third floor of the church building, and they had made this really neat children's library and drew like a rainbow and the ark and all kind of neat stuff. It was really pretty. So I was just doing a walkthrough before I went home that evening. And I got up there and I saw, oh, they left all their paint cans up here. And I thought, well, I'll just take them downstairs. And we had an elevator, and I said, I'll just walk to the elevator and ride down and take. So I had three paint cans. I think there were six cans in all, but three stacked high. And I started out. I got two steps outside of that library door, and the top can toppled off, and it landed right on the edge and popped the lid off and splattered paint on the wall, splattered paint on the bulletin board that the women had just done, and then just fell over, and then this big ooze of UT orange started growing bigger and bigger. Now, I might have gotten a raise at Carnes, you know, had I done that with that orange paint, but not in Kentucky, you know. And I'm thinking, oh no, my first thought is run away, you know, just pretend it wasn't me. Act shocked tomorrow morning, like, what in the world? My second thought was, oh man, I'm going to get fired. Nobody had even walked on this carpet, and now it's got a puddle about this big of UT orange. And so, you know, I went downstairs and, you know, I fought a little bit, and I got this wet dry vac, and I worked for hours and finally got it to where I don't think you could notice that it happened. But I knew what needed to be done, didn't know how to do it. And it took me a good while to figure it out. And I think that's sometimes where we are. Oh, I know, yeah, Jesus needs to be my everything, but how do I make that happen? What do I do to make him my everything? Can I give you 3 points tonight? And the lesson will be yours. And these are things that will help you to do that very thing, to make this not only the right answer, but the truthful answer in your life. The first thing is, if you want to make Jesus your everything, get involved. Start doing it. Start living it. Start making him your everything. It's, you know, here's the truth. Investment determines interest. Somebody was talking about the stock market today, and I know nothing about the stock market. You know why? I don't have any money. You know, I don't have any money in it. Oh, if I had a lot of money in it, I'd be really interested in it because I'd want to know everything. I don't read the Wall Street Journal. There's no need for me to read that. And this is an interesting phenomenon. My parents, for years, they would attend in the hot summer. They would get out these folding chairs and they'd go to Little League baseball games, sit there for hours, Little League baseball games. But I don't think my mom's been to a Little League baseball game in years, 40 years probably or more. Wonder why. She just lose interest in, well, actually she did. But you know why she had interest in the first place? Because her son played. And she had an investment in it. And when there's an investment in it, then your interest will naturally follow. And that's the way it works in every aspect of life. And then we come to religion and we wonder, like, I'm kind of bored. I don't like going to church. It's boring. And you know, it's just the same old thing. Listen, if you find your interest waning in church, I can almost assure you it's because you're not investing enough in it. You know, when you find a person who sits back and all they can do is criticize and critique the church and have, you know, unkind and unflattering things to say, you'll usually find a person who isn't investing themselves in that congregation. If you want to make Jesus your everything, invest yourself. And stop waiting for a convenient season. You remember Felix? And he said to Paul, you know, well, he called Paul. He's in this position of authority and he marches out here to Paul. He has Drusilla on his arm. And that's not his wife, but he's committing adultery with her. And he comes out and he says, okay, Paul, tell us about, we've heard a little bit about the way. Tell us a little bit about this Christianity that you're teaching. And boy, you know what Paul did? He reasoned with him concerning righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. Ouch. Because he wasn't living righteous. And he wasn't practicing self-control. He had another man's wife. And he was telling him, you're going to have to answer for this. It was direct and in his face. And Paul said, Felix said, well, I tell you what, if I ever get a convenient season, I'll call again for you and we'll talk some more about all this. But if you're waiting to get involved in Christianity to a time in your life when it's convenient, you never will. There's nothing convenient about denying self, taking up a cross and following Him. I don't care where you are in life. It doesn't matter if you're a teenager or 80 years old, 90 years old. It's not convenient. You have to say no to self. You have to take up a cross and you have to follow Jesus. That's not convenient and it never will be. If you think, well, you know, as soon as I get through these teenage years, I'll give my life to Christ. Well, what are you going to do when you're 20? Well, as soon as I get through college, I'll give my life to Christ. Well, what are you going to do when you're out of college and you started a job? Well, as soon as I get so far in this job, then I'll really give myself to the church and Christ and really get busy. And then you have a child and a wife and or a husband and you have children. Then what? When? Well, when my children get raised, then I'll really give myself over to the cause of Christ. And then you're tired because you've done everything else and you've given your attention to everything else. And do you see what I'm saying? You can just waste your life. You can always want another time to give yourself to God. And it's never easy. It's never convenient. You just have to make the decision, I'm going to do it. I'm going to put it into practice. And let me tell you this too. This is for parents in particular. If you want to raise children that are half-hearted and half-committed to the Lord, and who, when they get older, will walk away from the church, show them in your life that Jesus isn't really your everything. But you tell them that. Tell them that He is. But show them that He isn't. And that's the recipe for raising a child who resents Christianity and all that it stands for. What happens in the summertime when we've got soccer and baseball and basketball leagues, maybe in the wintertime, and we got band and we've got all these extracurricular things, and they fall on a Wednesday night? You know, back in the day, they didn't schedule those games on Wednesday night. When I played basketball and all those sports, they didn't schedule. And when they did have practice at 7 o'clock, I was leaving. That was just understood. But what the world realized is that we'll follow their lead. They can schedule on a Wednesday and we're going to just follow right along. And here's my question. When the kingdom schedule conflicts with our worldly schedule and our extracurricular schedule, which one wins? That's a question that I think we need to answer. You know, I can go to Genesis chapter 12 and verse 8, and I think there's an interesting passage there because what it talks about, and if I can use it as a backdrop, it makes this statement. Abraham built an altar to God and he pitched his tent. And I think we're doing exactly the opposite today. We're pitching our altars and we're building our tents. You see, the tent is just your dwelling place. And if you put it over here, if it starts raining and there's a gully washer coming down here, you can just pick that tent up and you can move it over here. But the place of worship, that's erected. That's not movable. It's not temporary. It's stationary. It stays. Abraham built his altars, but he pitched his tent. This had permanence. This could be moved. And I think we're doing the opposite today. When it comes to our extracurricular activities, our lifestyle, all of the things that we want to do, man, that is set in stone. Our social calendars cannot be deviated from. And if they happen to conflict with our spiritual calendar, well, I can't go to church that night because we have this. I can't be involved in that because it's backwards. And I'm telling you, you can preach all day long that Jesus is your everything to your kids, and you can tell them how that ought to be the case in their life, but you show them otherwise. And that's the recipe for disaster. We need to do more than just moralize and say, man, what's the world coming to? We need to have Jesus first in our lives. And we can talk about the world and the terrible things going on in our country and the problems that we're facing and the immorality that is rampant. And we can pat ourselves on the back and say, what a shame. But until we own up and adopt and begin to do the things that God calls for, they're just words. James 1:21 says we're to do more than just speak the truth, but we need to not only be hearers of the word, but doers of the word as well. So first thing, if you want to make Jesus your everything, practice. Put it in use. Invest yourself and your interest will follow. The second thing is this. We need to realize the presence of God in our life. I think that will help us to do the things that we're maybe sometimes reluctant to do, that are difficult for us to do. It gets us over the hump of, oh, that's really hard. I don't want to do that. Have you ever needed to mow your yard, but you don't want to? And there are things, or it's Thanksgiving Day and there's a mountain of dishes. Oh, where do you start? You know, there are some things that are unpleasant or difficult to do, and we find it difficult. And what I'm saying is, if we would realize the presence of God in our lives, it'll help us over the hump to do those things that we're not inclined to do. I really think the presence of God is something that we don't talk enough about, but it's something that gets us through and helps us to be strong. About 85, 90 years ago, there was a woman who had electricity run to her house for the very first time. She was thrilled with it, so excited. She'd heard all the things that it could do, and so she has it run to her house, and about 3 months later, some guys come and knock on her door, and they're from the electric company, and they say, ma'am, we just came by to check and see if you're having trouble, because it hasn't registered that you've used any electricity. And she said, oh, no, this is wonderful. And they said, yeah, but how do you, it's not registering that you're using any. And she said, oh, yes, I am. And so they said, well, explain to us how you use it. And she said, all right, well, I sit and I do my work through the day. And when it gets about dark at night or dusk, I get up and I flip the light on so I can see to light my candle. And I turn it off. And you see, that woman missed what was at her fingertips. She didn't realize the blessings that she had, and she wasn't appropriating them. And I think that that's our problem sometimes. We don't know what we have when the Bible promises us that God is with us. Psalm 139, read it sometime, the whole chapter. He talks about, where can I go to flee or escape the presence of God? He's everywhere. If I make my bed in Sheol, he's there. If I find the darkest place in the darkest night, he's there. He sees it. It's like daylight to him. I can't go anywhere without God seeing me. That's the point of the passage. And that's not supposed to be a scary passage. That's supposed to be a blessing. It's to tell us we're never alone. And our God is with us. And that should give us a sigh of relief. When our oldest daughter started kindergarten, I remember the very first day she had her backpack on, little thing, going off to school, going to have to get on a bus, and I hated that. And I told her, just stay home, don't go. And she said, Daddy, you know I have to go to school. And so she went off to school and went off to the bus stop. But you know what I did? I got in my car and I followed her. I followed her bus all the way to school. I saw her get off. And you know where I was at 2:30 that afternoon? I was at the school, and I followed her home to make sure she got home. I wasn't following her to catch her doing something wrong. I was there to make sure everything was okay. And that's the purpose of God's presence in our life. He's not a killjoy. He's not waiting to zap you with a lightning rod. That's not what he's doing. He's with us to help us and to strengthen us. And there's tremendous strength in the presence of another person. This is kind of silly, but it means something to me. When I was little, I had to walk through about five doors to get to my bedroom at bedtime. And what that meant was that there were about five opportunities for monsters to jump out and get me before I got there. And I used to dread when mom would say, it's time to go to bed. And I would like, yeah, oh, I've got to make that walk past those dark rooms. And so I was big into Batman and Robin. You remember the Adam West, Burt Ward, Biff, Bam, Pow, you know, Batman and Robin from the 60s? Not the dark stuff today. It was very light. And so I rode off and I got a button. You see this button? I don't know if you can see from there, but what it is, it's Batman and Robin. Here's what it says on it. It says, charter member of the Batman and Robin Society. Man, that was cool. I would put this on my pajamas, and no one's going to mess with it. I'm a charter member of the Batman and Robin Society, and I'd walk down the hallway with this on. No monster's going to mess with me now. Just the presence of this button. And I'm not a hoarder. You might think I'm a hoarder because I have some, but I'm not. But you would think, what's a button? Well, it was enough. It empowered me. It was sufficient to get me down the hall, and I wasn't afraid anymore because of this button. Crazy, but it's the way it works. Our youngest son and youngest daughter, when Anne-Marie was 2 and our other son was about 6, we might be upstairs and we'd say, Matthew, could you go downstairs and get something? And he'd go, downstairs? Yeah, go downstairs. But it's dark down there. Well, I know. Turn the light on. Yeah, but no one else is down there. And we would have this, Matthew, go downstairs and do this. And you know what he'd say? Hey, Anne-Marie, want to go downstairs with me? And so she's, yeah, you know, she's just 2 and she toddled along with him. And I thought, what is a 2-year-old going to do to help him going downstairs? Later, I figured it out. He was going to throw her to whatever it was and make his escape. But a 2-year-old empowered him to do what he was not inclined to do. The presence of a 2-year-old. Well, here's my point. If a button can help me do what I'm not inclined to do, if a 2-year-old can give you strength and encouragement to do what you're otherwise afraid to do, then what can the presence of God do to help us do what He asks us to do? Well, to ask that question, turn in your Bible for an answer. You got Daniel chapter 3 and about verse 23. Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were told that if they don't bow down, they would be cast into this fiery furnace. And they say, well, tough, we're not bowing. And oh, it made the king mad. And he heated up that fiery furnace 7 times hotter than it typically was. He binds those guys and he throws them in the furnace. The guys who threw him in the furnace died because the fire was so hot. And the king looks in there and he sees 4 men walking around. Well, he threw 3 in, but he sees 4. And the 4th one was like one of the sons of the gods. And so this is what I find interesting. He calls in and says, hey guys, come out of there. Do you not find that incredible? Because, you know, if we're having a bonfire outside, which is not a good idea, you know, right now. But if we were having a bonfire outside and somebody tripped and fell in that fire, would you just lay there and go, ouch, oh, ow, all this hot? You would jump up. You would get out. If two people threw you in just to be ugly and mean, whether you the pain registered or not, you would jump out just as fast as they threw you in. These men have been thrown in this fiery furnace. And the king has to go up to them and say, would you guys come out of there? Who has to tell people to come out of fire? Well, I'll tell you, those who are in the presence of God. You see, there was a fourth one in that fire with them, and they were so distracted by the presence of God, their circumstances didn't mean anything to them. How many times do we get so torn up about what's happening to us in life, and we're so distracted by that, we can't even function? But if we would be and keep our eyes on God and recognize that He's with us, those circumstances sure do shrink. It's not as big a deal after all, because He tells us He'll be with us. There's an occasion in the life of Elisha the prophet in 2 Kings chapter 6. Well, the Syrians were trying to destroy Israel, and every move the king made, it was thwarted. Every time they set an ambush, they weren't there. And so the king calls all of his advisors in and says, somebody has to confess. We've got a traitor among us. Somebody is telling the Israelites everything that we plan. And one of the men finally said, no, there's no traitors here. It's that prophet. He hears you in the privacy of your bedroom. He knows your plans because God is revealing it to him, and he's warning the people. So they said, we got to get rid of him. So by night, they surround the city, and in the morning, Elisha's servant goes outside, and he sees that they're surrounded. And he has a fit. You know, he runs back in, Elisha, we're surrounded, we're going to die, we're doomed, you know, there's no hope, they've got us. And Elisha, just as calm as can be, says, Lord, open his eyes. And then his eyes were open, and he saw that they were surrounded by chariots of fire. Angels had been sent by God to protect them. And don't you know, when he saw that, he must have gone, whew, man, I was scared there for a minute. I thought we were done for. But God's here. I'm just saying, if you want to make Jesus your everything, remember that God is with you. He'll help you through the tough times. Don't let the distractions of life, the pain that you have in your families and the scary things at work and your jobs and all of those kind of things, don't let that distract you from doing what God calls you to do. He's with you. And He promises that no matter what situation you're in, He'll take care of you. All things work together for good to those who love God and to those who are the called according to His purpose. And then here's the third thing that I want to give you. Live it. Remember God's presence. And here's the third thing. Count the cost. What's it going to cost you if you don't make Jesus your everything? You really want to do that? Quit just flying by the seat of your pants and think about, what is it that's at stake here? What impact do the choices have on my life? We need to slow down and think about it. In the Old Testament, Jacob and Esau, Esau's been out hunting and he comes back. He has this birthright, 2/3 of his father's inheritance. It's worth a lot of money. And he wants a bowl of soup. And Jacob says, well, I got this soup. I'll tell you what, I'll sell it to you for your birthright. And foolishly, and the Hebrew writer says, profanely, Esau says, okay, I'll sell it. I'm hungry. And he eats that bowl of soup, and then he says, man, that was dumb. I wish I had my birthright back. And the Bible says in Hebrews chapter 12 or 11 that he regretted the day that he made that decision, but there was never a time in his life that he could change that. Foolish, foolish decision. When I was a kid, I had a Do you remember those bikes that had the handlebars came up like that? They had a U, and then you had a banana seat, you know, and mine was a Huffy Cheater Slick. That's what it had on the little chain guard. It said Cheater Slick, and it had this tire, and smoke was coming off the back of it. And I loved the back tire of that bike because it had no tread. It was just slick, like a drag race car. And, you know, the fender on it even, the fender, it flared up. Man, it looked fast. I loved that bike. And one day, my neighbor said, "Hey, Steve, would you sell that bike? I've got a $5 bill." Well, I was still young, to show you my age, I was young enough that I was, $5? Wow. And I said, "Okay, I'll make a trade. I want that $5. And so I sold my Huffy banana seat cheater slick bike for $5. And I went home and I remember sitting at the supper table that night with my parents, and I pulled out my $5 bill and they said, "Where'd you get that?" And I said, "I sold my bike to Dave and McCoy for $5. Look what I have." And they proceeded to instruct me the value of a bike. And you know what? After they got done talking to me, I was mad because he had cheated me. And I didn't know it. And I wanted my bike back. But you know, my parents wouldn't let me have that bike back. They didn't say, "You go back over there and you give him that money back and you get your bike back." I just learned to walk everywhere that summer. And it was a lesson learned about, you know, the value of things and being hasty in decisions. And, you know, think about it. We have a birthright. Galatians chapter 3 says that we're all heirs of Abraham. We're his descendants. If we have faith in Jesus, we too are heirs of Abraham. And so we have a birthright. And think of what we sell that birthright for. Some people will sell it for a drink. Some people will sell it for a grudge that they won't let loose of. And some people will sell it for a moment of passion. And the list goes on and can be as silly and petty as a bowl of soup. We can look in the Bible and say, "Man, Esau, what in the world were you thinking?" But I think Esau could look at us and say, "You guys are no better than me. You've made as silly mistakes and silly decisions as I have made." Folks, we need to count the cost. What's it mean to sacrifice the agenda of God? Okay, I'm not going to make Jesus my everything, but here's what I get out of it. Is it worth it? What is there that you can get? And Jesus said, "What's a man profit if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" There's no good trade. If you sell, well, and this is an amazing concept too. The human soul, the most valuable possession that we have, is on the auction block every day. People trade it for the most insignificant of things. Do you want to make Jesus your everything? Then do these things. Invest yourself in the work of the kingdom, and your interests will follow. Recognize that God is with you and He'll be with you, and it'll minimize your circumstances because God is with you. And remember what it will cost you if you turn your back on Him. Do you really want to give up heaven for a devil's hell just so that you could fill in the blank? Just so that you could do that? It's not worth it. It's just a matter of putting things in priorities and perspective and keeping focus. And I'll close with this. A number of years ago, came home, our youngest daughter was just crying, throwing a fit, and Kim was in the kitchen, and she was trying to pull up on her leg. She couldn't even walk yet at the time, And I got that look from Kim, like, please take her somewhere. And so I got home from work and I took her and we went in the bedroom. And you know those little blocks, those wooden blocks that have the alphabet on them and stuff? We started stacking blocks. And I would stack them and she'd knock them over and she would laugh. She thought that was so funny. And so I would do that some more and she'd knock them over again and do it some more. She'd knock them over. And that got old after a while and she kind of crawled off on the other side of the room, but I just continued building. And pretty soon I had a pretty neat little building going and she eyed that and here she comes back crawling toward this building that I'm making. And when she got close enough to swat at it, I like stopped her and pushed her away. And she just looked at me like, what did you just do? And so she came at it again and I pushed her away again. I'm making a pretty neat castle here. And she pushed her away a third time and that bottom lip puckered out and she began to boo-hoo cry. And it dawned on me, I'm 40 years old playing with blocks. And my daughter, I won't let her play. I'd totally forgotten the focus and the purpose of why I was in there. I was in there to stop her from crying. And I forgot my purpose. And here she was crying again. Don't forget your purpose in life. It's easy to do. Man, Jesus was perfect. I mean, at the age of 12, I must be about my Father's business. And all of his life, he said, man, it is meat for me. It is food for me to do the will of my Father. And as he dies on the cross, he says, it is finished. Everything about him was totally, perfectly focused on his mission of serving his Father. And I wish I could be like that. I'm not. I forget. I make mistakes. I lose my focus. But we need to be reminded. Don't lose focus. What are we here for? Let's glorify God. Let's serve Him with all of our might. Let's make Jesus our everything. And we'll never have regret. But I'll tell you, there are a lot of people that will go to the judgment who knew better, who once lived better, but they lost focus. Jesus just became one of many things that were, I don't know, involvements in their life. And they would give anything to have it back. Don't be that person. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, you know, I need to do that. I need to make him my everything. Begin tonight. Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. If you need to obey the gospel, we'll help you in that. If you're a child of God already but unfaithful and it's time to come back home, we'll pray with you if you'll come as we stand together and sing.